Hello and welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast. My name is Greg Langan, the Writers in Schools Program Coordinator for the Penn Faulkner Foundation. It is my pleasure to share with you an evening with Edna O'Brien. She joined us this spring at 6th and I Historic Synagogue to share with us her latest novel, The Little Red Chairs, her first novel in a decade. Hailed by many as the doyen of Irish literature, Edna O'Brien is the author of such classic works as The Country Girls Trilogy, The Love Object and Other Stories, and Saints and Sinners. She was joined on stage by fellow novelist Steve Goodwin. It was a great night, and I hope that you enjoy this event as much as we did.
Good evening. My name is Emma Snyder, and as the Executive Director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you here on behalf of both Penn Faulkner and 6th and I for a reading and conversation with the absolutely extraordinary Edna O'Brien. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz has called 6th and I a utopian model for what is possible for a community center, a revitalized historic space that looks boldly toward the future of spiritual and cultural engagement. For a now 108-year-old building, originally intended to be a house of worship, 6th and I has transcended its roots since its founding in 2004 to become a sanctuary for spirituality, live entertainment, and insightful conversation like what you'll hear tonight. Authors they'll welcome in the coming months include Arianna Huffington, Angela Duckworth, Moby, Buzz Aldrin, Andrew Solomon, and Don DeLillo. Quite a range. A commitment to bringing creative and thoughtful programming to the DC community is a value that 6th and I and the Penn Faulkner Foundation share. At Penn Faulkner, we work to build audiences for and create communities around books. We honor great literature through the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, which will be announced this coming Tuesday, so pay attention. We take writers into schools, into public schools throughout DC and Baltimore through our Writers in Schools program. And we feel incredibly lucky when we get to present the finest working writers to the readers of DC in public events like this one tonight. Just this morning, I, maybe like many of you, went to the New York Times and opened up the book review and saw The Little Red Chairs on the cover, where Joyce Carol Oates called it, among other things, boldly imagined and harrowing, an unsettling, fabulous vision. I sat there and I thought to myself, what an incredible privilege it is to get to hear Edna O'Brien in person about that vision this evening. To lead us in that conversation is a beloved member of the Penn Faulkner family, Stephen Goodwin. Steve is formerly the president of Penn Faulkner's board. He's a professor at George Mason University, a professor of creative writing. He served as the literature director at the NEA and is the author of many short stories, essays, and three novels, Breaking Her Fall, The Blood of Paradise, and Kin. He's a deeply generous and thoughtful person and reader and an ardent admirer of Edna's work. We're in for a wonderful evening. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Edna O'Brien and Stephen Goodwin.
As I've read her prose over the last few weeks, I've been reminded that no one anywhere writes more beautiful sentences than hers. She is a consummate artist. She's also been a writer who made a difference in Ireland, especially. She's been a force, a trailblazer for generations of young women. I've heard it said that in Ireland, you learn sin from the priests, Latin from the nuns, and passion from Edna O'Brien. Today, there's agreement that she's one of Ireland's greatest writers, but this was not always the case. Her first book, Country Girls, written in just 3 weeks in a burst of energy, was greeted with outrage and made her persona non grata in Ireland when it was published in 1960. This coming-of-age story about two Irish girls did not turn away from the taboo subjects of women's sexual needs and desires. The book was banned by the clergy, and a few copies were even publicly burned. For those inclined to judge her, it made matters worse that she had left Ireland for London, where she lived what appeared to be a scandalous life, hobnobbing with stars of the 60s. The house she owned on the Thames became a party house, and many leading men and women of the decade stopped by. One night, she found herself dancing with the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson. Another night, Paul McCartney stopped by to sing a lullaby to her sons. Reluctantly, I pass over the cameo appearances of Marlon Brando, Robert Mitchum, Sean Connery, Jackie Onassis, and Jane Fonda, and urge you to read about them in her wonderful memoir, Country Girl. By the end of the decade, a certain image of Edna O'Brien was set firmly in place. She was the glamorous, russet-haired beauty who dared to leave Catholic Ireland to follow her own desires and write frankly and bravely about women who rejected the traditional roles available to them. She led a cosmopolitan life. She was the friend and confidant of the great and famous, and though a celebrity herself, she was not always taken seriously as a writer in her own words. As a writer, I was deemed wanton and irrational, and my range was thought to be narrow and obsessional, a mere concoction of cliches aimed at foreigners. She set about changing that perception. If you read the memoir, Country Girl, you will discover that the true interlude story of her life is the story of a writer's lifelong development. Her abiding passions have been reading and writing, and she kept demanding more and more of herself, testing her powers, pushing her talents into new places. Just look at the body of her work, 15 novels, 8 books of stories, biographies of James Joyce and Lord Byron, 5 plays, including one based on the life of Virginia Woolf, and 2 memoirs. In all, there are more than 30 books, and they have long since moved on from the early stories about those innocent, delicate, and vulnerable country girls. Recent subjects have often come cloaked in terrifying and tragic historical, political, and moral complications. Which brings me to her most recent novel, The Little Red Chairs. It is as daring as anything she's ever written, a story that begins when a war criminal turns up in a small Irish town masquerading as a healer. It has been called a masterpiece by Philip Roth. And it shows us how global terrors reach us no matter where we are. While it is a departure for Edna O'Brien in terms of its material, it is built with sentences that could only be hers. They have her phrasing, her canniness, her earthiness, her awareness of beauty alongside the knowledge of sorrow. And as always, she makes us care about the characters. Not just about their psyches, but about their souls. And we do not doubt ever that they have souls. This is the kind of art that makes us feel more alive. I am very happy to welcome her to this place and this podium. She's going to read for about 20 minutes from the Little Red Chairs. Edna O'Brien.
Is a quotation from Roberto Bolano. An individual is no match for history. And I'm going to read you pages of the first chapter and then 2 more little sections. So here we go. The town takes its name from the river. The current, swift and dangerous, surges with a manic cleaver. Chunks of wood and logs of ice borne along in its train. In the small sidings, where water is trapped, stones, blue, black, and purple, shine up out of the riverbed, perfectly smoothed and rounded. And it is as though seeing a clutch of good-sized eggs in a bucket of water. The noise is deafening. From the slenderest twigs of the overhanging trees is a folk park. The melting ice drips, drips with the soft, susurrous sound. And the hooped metal sculpture, an eyesore to so many locals, is improved by a straggling necklace of icicles. Icicles, bluish in that frosted night. Had he ventured in further, the stranger would have seen the flags of several countries, an indication of how cosmopolitan the place had become. But he stays by the water's edge, apparently mesmerized by it. Bearded and in a long dark coat and white gloves, he stands on the narrow bridge, looks down at the roaring currents, then looks around, seemingly a little lost. His presence, the single curiosity in the monotony of a winter evening in a freezing backwater that passes for a town and is called Cunaila. Long afterwards, there would be those who reported strange occurrences on that winter night. Dogs barking crazily as they do in thunder, and the sound of the nightingale, whose song and warblings were never heard so far distant. The child of a gypsy family who lived in a caravan by the sea swore she saw the Pooka man coming through the window at her, pointing an axe. Dara, the young man, the hair spiked and plastered with gel, beams when he hears the tentative lift of the door latch and thinks, a customer at last. With the fecking, drinking, driving laws, business is dire. Married men and bachelors up the country, parched for a couple of pints, were too afraid to risk it with guards watching their every sip, squeezing the simple joys of life away. "Evening, sir," he says, as he opens the door, sticks his head out, remarks on the shocking weather, and then both men, the stranger and he, in some initiation of camaraderie, fill their lungs manfully. Dara felt that he should genuflect. He looked around more carefully at the figure, like a holy man with a white beard, white hair, and a long black. The stranger wore white gloves, which he removed slowly, finger by finger, and looking around uneasily, as if he were being watched. He was invited to sit on the good leather armchair by the fire, and Dara threw a pile of briquettes on and a pinch of sugar to build up a blaze. It was the least he could do for a stranger. The man had come to inquire about lodgings, and Dara said, he would put the thinking cap on. A blatherer by nature, Dara begins to unfold his personal history. My mother, pure saint. My father, big into youth clubs, but very against drugs and alcohol. My little niece, my pride and joy, just started school, has a new friend, Jennifer. I work two bars, here at TJ's and the castle at weekends. Footballers come to the castle. Absolute gentleman. I got my photo taken with one. Read Pele's autobiography. Powerful stuff, powerful. I'll be going to England to Wembley later on for a friendly with England with them. We booked our flights, six of us, the accommodation in a hostel. It's bound to be a gas. Oh, I go to the gym, do a bit of cardio on the plank, love my job. Love my job. My motto is fail to prepare, prepare to fail. Never drink on the job, but I like a good pint of Guinness when I'm out with the lads. Love the football. Love the films too. Saw a great film with Christian Bale. Oh, he's the Dark Knight and all. But I wouldn't be in horror now, no way. The visitor has roused himself somewhat and is looking around, apparently intrigued by the bric-a-brac in nooks and crannies, stuff that Moira, the owner, has gathered over the years, porter and beer bottles, cigarette cartons with ornamental lettering, and a ceramic baby barrel with a gold tap and the name of the sherry from the region in Spain that it was made. Dara's at his wit's end, scrapping the head with a pencil, jotting down the names of the various B&Bs, and regretting that most of them are shop for the winter. He tried Dearborn, then Grolia, but no answer. Three other joints, gets a machine. The machine bluntly telling callers that no left message must be left. Then he remembered Fifi, a bit of a card, went home from Australia, but she was not home either. Probably at some meditation or chanting gig, new age junkie into prana and karma, and that sort of thing. And his last chance is the Country House Hotel, even though he knew they were shut, and husband and wife were going to India. He got his salt, the wife. No way, no way, she said, but with a bit of soft soaping, she relents. One night only. He knew her, he delivered things there. Wine and fresh fish and lobster from the quayside. Their avenue was miles long, twisting and turning, shaded with massive old trees, a deer park on one side, and their own river, sister to the town river, a humped bridge, and then more avenue, right up to the front lawn, where peacocks strutted and did their business. Once, when he stepped out of the van, he happened to catch this great sight. A peacock opening his tail out like a concertina, the green and the blue, with the richness of a stained glass, an absolute pageant. Some visitors, it seemed, complained about the cries of the peacocks at night, said it had the weirdness of an infant in distress. But then, as he said, people will get funny notions into their head. A youngster comes in to gawk at the stranger with the dark glasses and begins to roar with laughter. Then one of the Mugovan sisters comes and tried to engage him in conversation. But the stranger was lost, thinking his own thoughts and muttering to himself in his own tongue. And after she left, he was more relaxed, let the coat slide off his shoulders, said he had been traveling for days, but did not say where he had been traveling from. "It is an honor to have you, sir," Dara said, and he left the tired man to his meditation. As into a little passbook, he wrote down the date and itemized the two brandies that he had served the man. The visitor said in his part of the world, brandy was made from plums and damsons, and it was known as Raika, and was at least 40% proof. It was mandatory at baptisms, weddings, and the gravesides of warriors. Mandatory, Dara liked the fullness of that word in the mouth. "Where would your part of the world be?" he asked, eventually to ask. "Montenegro," he was told. "But I am known as Vuk," the man said, and with a tentative smile, told that the Vuk was a popular name for sons in his homeland, because of a legend attached to it concerning a woman who had lost several infants in succession, deciding to name her newborn Vuk, meaning wolf, because the witches who ate the babies would be too terrified to confront a wolf child. Well, they were getting on great. When Dara, to his utter annoyance, the bloody telephone rang again. and it was Isol from the country house, wanting to know when the guest was arriving and if crab claws would be okay for supper. He stood in the doorway, under a sliver of moon, watched the man go down the slip road, the ice cracking under his feet, footsteps getting fainter and fainter as he crossed the bridge, away from the roar of the river, to a sister river that was not nearly so rapid. And he took gulps of air, promised priming himself, knowing the bar would fill up within minutes, and he would have to provide a blow-by-blow account, a summary of the strange encounter. Desiree was first, a strapping girl in a pink mini dress on a winter night, her stout arms bare and a coat over her head, bursting for news. God, I could do with a fella. Haven't had a fella for half a year, she said, curious to know if the guy was presentable and married or single. Did he wear a ring? And then the Mugovan sisters came slinking in their grey coats and their knitted caps, ordering one peppermint cordial for two. And Fifi came with some of her friends. Mona, the owner, alerted by the hilarity, came down from her living quarters. And like any customer, she sat on one of the high stools and ordered her usual tip, a large port wine with a slice of orange. A widow for over 20 years. She always dressed nicely in dark crepe dresses, the corsage of violets on her ample bosom. And she spoke in a soft, breathy voice. Mona had two staples in life. One was Padre Pio, in whom she had an unwavering faith. And the other was the romance novels, of which she could never get enough. She devoured them the way she devoured fudge in bed at night, and looked forward, looked around. She welcomed the fact that the bar was filling up, as things had been woeful since Christmas. There was the local policeman, the ex-school teacher, and Dante, the town punk, flanked by his cohorts, Ned, who had done time for growing marijuana in a window box, and Ambrose, for stealing lead pipes from the contractor he worked for. But business had bucked up, and Dara was proud to announce that the stranger was an out-and-out gentleman, down to his pointy shoes. And soon he had them in the palm of his hands, adding a few flourishes of his own. The man's long fingers, expressive as a pianist, the signet ring of the crest of an eagle. Although a toff, as he had to remind him, there was also the aura around this man as of a holy person, like those pilgrims that travel around Russia barefoot, doing good deeds. And he mentioned the plum brandy that was mandatory at weddings. Dante, the town punk, could be listening. And presently, with a nod from Mona, began to play on the old bar organ, his soft brown hair falling over his face, his team waiting for their cue. Demands for Irish coffee were legion. Dara complimented on the fact that he could keep talking and still have a nifty way of getting the cream down the back of the spoon before it trembled onto the coffee. The music got wilder, thumpier, cohorts doing their scherzos and trills with the spoons, and Desiree did her mock striptease. Dante was on his feet, tripping around, hovering above each one. The shaman he was, whispering the prophecy. Santa didn't come. His brother took his place. Santa's dead. Santa's dead. That's what he said. Annihilated on his sled. That's what he said. So this is it, son. This is it. Dark, dark shit. Mona, a little tickly on her perch, pressed the violets to her bosom and said, but maybe the man will bring a bit of romance into our lives. And outside, the thermometer on the folk park gate read -3. while inside they basked in the warmth of a fire that had been going since morning. Spirals of smoke drifted throughout the room, their faces curious, jovial, dreamy, wreathed in smoke, like beings captured in some strange nocturnal bacchanalia. So the man begins to find his way in this town and townland, and before long everyone is enthralled to him, even the local priest who first feared that the man having the word sex therapist on his card might be bad. But the person most enthralled to him was the town beauty, a woman called Fidelma McBride. Fidelma McBride, who had a little boutique and went to France once a year to buy couture, including corsets with diamante. So she falls under his spell, and more than that, she has wanted a child from her husband, to whom she's been married a long time, her older husband, but that didn't happen. So with great persuasion and wooing, and little gifts of cheese straws left on the step where he practices as the healer, he finally agrees to meet her in a hotel far away, far from where Clonaila is. And this is a few moments of that encounter, which in a way is there are many parts of the book are pivotal, but this is very pivotal because it takes the story away from that place, away to the world beyond with even deeper consequences. They have begun to make love, and then it stopped because she felt he was doing it as if like the scientist and not like the man. She went into the hotel garden and sat down. The garden was empty, no echoes of the giddy communicants or a group that had been at dinner. The grass was damp and cool under her bare feet. And there were several smells from the grass itself, from the clay of the flower beds, and above all from the night-scented stock that flourished everywhere. And bats flew in erratic, random swoops. And his white shirt seemed like a banner under the half moon, unless it was another man in an identical white shirt coming towards her. How long had she been there? He had heard her sing in the bedroom and came down now to say how beautiful her voice was. Uninvited, he sat on the bench. "I thought I could be the scientist, not the man," he said. She didn't answer. He said two other things also, which throughout she didn't answer. Had she imagined him to be a man with a dark desire, particularly with an enchanting woman such as she? And he told her the moment when he was first attracted to her and how many nights he swam alone in Kilcooney Cove, thinking she just might be there. And then he put his arms around her and said, "You are mine now. I can drown my eyes in your hair." And he carried her across the garden, up the spiral steps and onto the tossed bed. The candle still burned, and she asked him to light the taller one that was in a sconce on the bureau. They sat side by side and she helped him undress. She had broken through to the real him, the poet, the man of feeling that she always knew to be there. She held his beard and wagged it, as she had so often done in her imagination, fingering it like it was flaked tobacco. And he asked what poem or piece of literature in her country most best expressed the wooing of a beautiful lady. She said it was a playboy who said he had killed his dad and wandered into County Mayo to boast of his feats, and that all the women of Connacht fell for him. But he chose one girl in that playboy, Peggy Mike, envisaging for her out on the side of Nephin, where he would kiss her onto her necklace. "Onto your necklace," he said, and kissed her, and they lay down on his body next to hers, seeking her with his hands, with his mouth, with his whole being, as if in the name of love, or what she believed to be love. He could not get enough of her. Afterwards, he spread the strands of her black hair along the pillow. He smelt it, he kissed it, he tasted it. She would remember this forever. This room with the candles burning down, the smell of warm wax, yellow roses opening in the heat, as outside the sky was a deep vault of blue, that soft, satiny blue, when night has her to herself. And afterwards he lets her sleep and goes to the adjoining room. And in the morning he comes to say goodbye. He's a very changed man. His manners changed, his mood, his clothing, his businesslike. And he says, "The coming weeks will answer all our questions, Fidelma," meaning, of course, if she has got pregnant. "But we will meet," she says. "We must not get your story mixed up with my story," he said. "What is your story, Vlad?" She would barely hide her dismay. "My sacred duty is to God and my own people," he said in the words of a preacher. And later, when he had gone, she went with the porter, as she had promised, to see sculptures. There they were by a wall, hoops of bronze, black and amber, affixed to a wire mesh. Sculptures about love, but with no revelation, no trace of the passions that had informed them. Tall grasses growing up around each one, guarding the weathered silence. Later that day, she drives home, and her husband, Jack, meets her in the doorway, a reproachful look in his eyes because she was 1 hour late. He believed, or half believed, that she had gone to a Carmelite convent for 2 days of fast, because that was what she told him. He wore an old brown leather glove that was usually on a shelf in the potting shed, and thrusting it at her, he said, "Look, look." Then he opened it to reveal the ooze of a bat that he had squashed again. Two, as he said, had come in the night, and when he got up and later went to wash his hands, he found them in the wash basin. Together, two bats like vampires. The moment he touched them, they began to fly in big circuits out of the bathroom, into the hall, up to the high ceiling, passing back and forth before his eyes, in winding, evil loops. He had to go outside and get the stepladder, and then stand on the top rung, hitting out with the sole of his slipper to lure the bats down so he could do for them. Eventually, he belted one that fell into the tall boy with the maidenhair fern, and seizing the china flower pot, he squashed it to death. Blood and pus spewing out like slime, black, bloodied, while the second one, the she-devil, escaped through the window. "I would have popped her too," he said. Such seething words from her husband, a man who had never harmed anyone in his whole life. "Oh, poor Jack," she said. "Poor Jack," he said sourly, adding that he had not a wink of sleep. And she heard herself saying they would go out for dinner. They would have a celebration. They would go over to Renville, where they went each June on their wedding anniversary. "We can't afford it," he said. She panicked. She said there were buyers for their pair of antique mirrors in their clothes shop, and also for the silver lampstand in the shop. And eventually he agreed, and she brought him upstairs, drew the blinds in their bedroom, put a rug wool over him, and went out. long before they were ready to set out for the dinner, Jack was in the hall with his coat on, pacing back and forth, rattling the small change in his pocket, as he always did, telling her to hurry up, hurry up. How the sound of those footsteps, the rattle of that loose change, his punctuality, his bursts of affection, how they now repelled her. The dining room in the hotel where they were sat for dinner was so contrasting with the previous evening, everything shabbier, frayed embroideries, dust in the folds of the taffeta curtains, faded photographs of ancestry, and little knick-knacks all fallen into neglect. And melancholy, the world she no longer wanted to be in. From the two sherries, Jack's eyes had clouded as he leant over her, and with a terrible and weeping ardor, he said too loudly, that no man had a wife so beautiful and so constant. So the story has, or at least in so much as I could convey it to you, the man and the woman, the stranger, and the town romantic have brought it or conceived a child. And almost as soon as that happened, the man leaves that village because some graffiti in his own language, which is Serbian, and in English language, are painted in cardinal red on the town pavement. And Fidelma begins to know, to realize, that this man is not going to be there for her. He leaves the town because his car has been broken into, and he senses danger. Danger now is beginning to hover over this whole place, including the danger or the consequence for her of what's in her belly. And he came back out of vanity about 6 weeks later because he had agreed to read his own poetry, not Yeats's, his own poetry at Yeats's tomb, or grave in Sligo. And they all set out on a bus tour, on a bus driven by a Polish driver. So they're chatting in the bus, and Vlad, Dr. Vlad, doesn't speak to Fidelma, doesn't speak to her. She's sitting way back in the bus. He's sitting alone going through his poetry. People are admiring the bit of sunshine and having passing sandwiches around. And there's a general hilarity and happiness. And one woman who has lost her marbles keeps saying, "I see the sea," even when she was looking at land. But as they're going along this country road, the bus is stopped by one unfamiliar guard, a policeman, and a second unfamiliar policeman comes in. Vlad is arrested. And he goes, where he goes, handcuffed. And Fidelma now knows that something is very wrong. Within 3 hours, in Dara's pub, or the pub he works for on World Television, is the whole story of this man, who he is, who he was, the thousands he's had killed, the concentration camps, the slaughter, the refugees, the whole carnage of war, the siege of Sarajevo, the massacre of Srebrenica, everything. And Fidelma is alone in her own sitting room with her husband, who is watching it. And it becomes more and more, she realizes she's holding this baby, this, as she now calls it, this monster child inside her. And she says to her husband, "Turn it off," meaning the television. And if he says, "If it disgusts you so much, go in the kitchen," which she does. She doesn't know what she would do. She can't tell her husband, she can't tell anyone. And the only man she wanted to tell it to is now gone to a court. And later that night, which I will not read, I would rather you read it yourselves, because it is a harrowing, as someone has noted, chapter. 3 men come, and they ask her to come out with them. She thinks they can go to the castle or to Dara's pub and have a drink. but she already senses danger when she goes out and gets into that hired car. The men are drunk. They're passing a bottle of vodka one to the other. The driver is black from Nigeria, Tyrone, and he's praying and quoting from the Psalms. So in that drive, she anticipates something bad would happen to her, but she couldn't possibly anticipate what did happen. And as a result of it, Dr. Vlad has gone to The Hague, to the tribunal in Hague, or has been going, and she, Fidelma, has to leave that town. So she comes to England penniless and looking for work and joins that world of the lost, the abandoned, and those who can't go home. The time passes, as it has to, in fiction. And the last little section I will read to you is, she follows the career of Dr. Vlad, although at first she didn't wish to, and she realizes that he is going to be tried. After some 2 years, the case has come up for trial in which public are admitted. And with difficulty, she manages to get a ticket. She sees him there, absolutely staunch, persuasive, and with the same bravura that he always had. And then, again, with some negotiation, she gets a pass to visit him alone in prison. And this is called the prison visit. The prison was a few kilometers outside the center in a seaside suburb. The taxi driver chose the sitting route so that she had a view of the North Sea, with one ship plowing the gray, bleak waters, big waves rising up around it, a cold, lonely sea. There was a continuum of all loneliness. The prison was flanked by two tall towers, and though it was only 4 o'clock, darkness was coming on, and the brick facade was the color of dried blood. Security was far more strict than at the court, and she was passed from one guard to the next, their faces under the fluorescent lighting pallid and identical, sour and sullen, and eyeing her, the visitor, with suspicion. The detention rooms, where he and half a dozen others were being held, was at the end of a long corridor, and as she followed the broad back of a guard, her decisiveness began to falter. Dr. Vlad greeted her warmly, arm outstretched. "Let me look at you. Still beautiful, a little too thin, perhaps." He seemed, with his excessive compliments, to be oblivious to the guard who was standing there as Vlad continued with his tribute. She had come, oh, she had come in his hour of need. "How are you, Vlad?" And he smiled at the recollection of the old name and the old days. They sat at a little metal table that was stacked with a batch of papers, which he began to lay out. "I brought this," she said, and took out the black chiffon scarf with the smell of verbena, with which he had blinded her the night they made love. He seemed to ignore it. "Don't you remember?" she said. And she held it up for him to see and maybe even to smell. He acted as if he did not understand her. Perhaps she was some simpleton that he once knew. "You were in that court, Fidelma," his voice is booming now. "You saw, you heard them. They painted me a monster, when all the time in that war I was seeking to create a homogeneous peace. You know me, you knew me. In our personal association, did you find me a monster?" "It's the only good memory I have of us," she said, crushing the scarf in her hand. "I am a poet," he says. "I am a poet. I am an artist. I am a humanist, for Christ's sake. Caged in this stinking universe for crimes I have not committed. I wanted to write to you, but I did not know how to put it," she said, leaning closer to him and anxious now. "Oh, Kafka, come back and help me overcome these shitty ladies and gentlemen enrobed in that court on their high streets. thrones. Truthfulness is dead, and I am the one who must prove it, he says. The morning you were taken off the bus, she began. News traveled like wildfire. TJ's was packed. People drove from all over to watch the big screen. There you were, the you they did not know, the you I did not know. And then witnesses told their stories about you, and shoes and objects were pelted at your face on the screen. Fifi fainted. Nothing of emotion or even surprise registered on his face as he held up the sheaf of papers. Not a single piece of evidence ordering atrocities was ever signed by me. The pages were in different inks with question marks, annotations all over them. I was watching in my house, she says. I was watching with my husband. He knew nothing of our love. For example, lad, reeled off, page and paragraph, D1329, D2335, D2986, D2168, D2170, D3575, D513, D2605606, and so on. It was only a matter of will now. It was not only a matter of will now, but alacrity. Who could outdo whom? Who could speak first? I was 10 weeks pregnant, she said. There was no one I could tell, not even you, its father. He looked at her, then shook his head sternly from side to side. How dare she compromise him in front of a guard, a menial? I am not a nationalist, he said, addressing the guard now, but I think racists should not mix. When I meet a real Frenchman or a real German or a real Irishman, they have something that flowers have, a distinct scent of their own. It was being said, of course, to deflect her. But she was more determined, her anger mounting. Three men knocked on our door. My husband answered it. They had business with me, or rather with you, whom they had come for. But you had escaped them. Interpol had taken you. Do you know, he went on, I have received many prominent awards for my books in many languages. I've also written a comedy and a novel, The Wondrous Chronicles of the Night. She interrupts. They brought me, the three men, way up the mountain to a hut, refusing to be thwarted. The one they called the medical took out a crowbar. Fidelma, he says, one does not talk of a rope in the house of a hanged man. You have to hear me out, she says. You mustn't dramatize, he says. My world in bits and the child. Again, he stops her. People who converse with God know that I am innocent, and he is bellowing it into her ear. You know everything you have done, she told him. You know everything you have done. And in a way, I wish you were mad, but you are not mad. You are one of Lucifer's lying liars. You are a monster. There is the instantaneous eruption as he stands up, papers flying in all directions. Wait, wait, wait! He orders the guard in Dutch and English to get her out. And she is gripped by the elbows from behind, the blades of both shoulders lifted in a clench, and then marched outside to where the burly doorman is seated. And together, the two guards talk in their own language. And she wondered what they were saying. Perhaps that she had assaulted the prisoner, or that she was a nutcase, or that she should be placed under arrest. But she does manage to get out of there after they have emptied the contents of her handbag and treated her appallingly with a disdain and the just stasis. She has to sit there. Will she get out of there? Outside was deserted, the searchlight showing mist on a plot of grass over which she ran wildly, not once daring to look back, passing a little row of dwellings, houses with clouds, and china dogs in the winter. Nor a mallet up on the road in search of a taxi, except the Bosman. boarding the first bus that came along, there was hiatus. She did not remember the name of the street where the hotel was. Dan Haag, Holland Square, the driver said. Selwood, Dan Haag. But she, finally, a woman from the front seat of the bus said, "Where do you wish to go?" "The center," she said. "Central," the woman said, and the driver repeated it. And now Central, like Sunday morning bells, rang jubilantly as the bus set off. In the glass of the window, going along the leafy suburbs, she saw her startled self. And then she saw his face appearing, floating up there, the vengeful eyes, the lip snarled to one side. "Wait, wait, out, out." And she huddled into her coat for protection. And as they used to say in the time of Charles Dickens, when he wrote for the magazine one part of a chapter of a book each week, or maybe it was each month, all I can say gratefully to you is to be continued. Thank you.
This novel, The Little Red Chairs. I want to get to that in a moment, but I hope you won't mind if I start by asking you a couple of low-minded questions.
Holy chairs.
One is about the life that you led in London and about that magical house that you describe. It seems so different from anything that could happen now. All these people coming and going, but there's not the great hoo-ha about it. There are no paparazzi. I mean, do you think of it as a time of glamour or a time of innocence?
I think the fame of great celebrity is very different now. It has lost its way. Famous people, either male or female, are surrounded by cohorts. They all wear dark glasses. They're all distasteful. Intimacy or any kind of connection is lost. And that is because the world itself, not just for famous people, but for everything, the world itself, through information, through networking, through Twitter, blah, 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 the world has changed. So you wouldn't find Marlon Brando giving you a lift home if you were alive. And I'm not even sure if he'd ask his driver to give you a lift home. And I find that a pity. But there's nothing to be done about it. When you say about the lovely house, I would like, since I'm in love with Russian literature, always have been, always will be, my favorite character in the world, heroine, is Madame Raevskaya, who had a cherry orchard. Through that well-known thing called love, and that other well-known thing, profligacy, there's a big word, she lost her cherry orchard. I, who lived in that house, also lost my house through that thing called love and profligacy. But everything, I think, is kind of a lesson. And like leaving Ireland or leaving that house, one writes better, more intensely, and with a sharper focus of seeing and of memory when one has left a place. It's ironic, but when you're in a place, that's, you don't see it. You're seeing it, you're absorbing it all, but the camera doesn't actually give you the picture until you've gone from it. So I sometimes walk past that house, because I live in London, and that was, so to speak, my own house, which is not the case now. I walked past it, and once I did a foolish thing, luckily unperceived. I thought, I'll walk down there, and I'll sit on the step There are nice steps up to it, like lovely houses I passed today in the streets here. And I thought, talk of nonsense or fairy tale thinking. I thought somebody will come out and say, come in, this is your house. I still think foolish.
Let me ask you a question about love. When you met with Brando, I don't remember whether you told him that you write. But for you, there were two kinds of men. There were brothers.
And if there were what?
There were two kinds of men. There were brothers and there were lovers. For you.
Yes. Probably 20 kinds of men.
Well, one role that wasn't there was husband. You were married once, but never married again. Did you feel that you had to make the choice that Yeats described between... Make the choice that Yeats described between the perfection of the life and the perfection of the life.
I think sometimes one doesn't articulate these things to oneself. First of all, I wasn't that happily married. Tolstoy would understand if he was. And secondly, I was married to a writer who stopped writing and somehow found or believed mistakenly, that it was my fault. It was a bit like Colette and her husband Willie. He wanted me to write, but he also resented it. But that's gone. As regards never again marrying, I did, as Joyce would word it, at first we feel, then we fall. I did fall in love 2.5 more times. But I did not marry. I don't think I was asked even to be married again. In terms of serious answer to your question, however, is this. Without wording it to myself, Edna, you can't do both. You either choose, which path will you choose in the forest? The writing path or the wife path? It is harder to be a woman as a writer. I know male writers, and as I said somewhere the other day, and it's honestly the truth, wives leave trays outside their door so they're not disturbed in their studies. But I have to be my own tray. And I had young children, well, they were 8 or 9, whatever, by then. And so I had my children to rear, and that actually was lovely, because a man might resent a woman, a wife, or a lover, not giving him as much time as he wished or needed or hoped. Children will complain, as my children, when I'd work, and I'd say, you have to play now for a bit. I've got to concentrate. They would talk gibberish, like, we wish to talk to you about the distillation of gin. That was one of the things. Another time, I was working in a little, like, garden hut, so I could leave all my papers on a table undisturbed. I write by hand, and I constantly lose. I lost bits of the little red chairs, had to go through dustbins to find that. So I'm in this little hut, it has a window, and they're supposed to be playing. So what they do, being little scallywags, is they write me a note signed by both, which says, we are missing you, we think we are ill. As much good humor would have emanated from man. But I would say other people, friends of mine, not people who are scolding me, have said to me that probably the wish, the will, the desire, the longing, the everything to write superseding everything. You see, when you're writing, as you know, Stephen, you've written novels as well. And short stories are also hard, but the span of a novel is a longer time. You have to stay with it all the time. You have it in your mind when you go to bed, when you sleep, when you dream, when you wake up. And outside, there's a ruthlessness in it as well, as I'm sure there is to some extent in me. So you have to keep with that. It's lonely, it's hermetic, it's ruthless, but it's essential, because the novel every little second of the novel, every single word, 80 or 90,000 words, has to be found. Some are already found. But have you lost them? So there's a constant, and I wouldn't wish or hope to sound in any way pretentious about it. I don't mean to be pretentious. There's a constant fret and anxiety, which is really always there, like a ghost behind you saying, you're going to lose it, you're going to lose it. And that, I think, would be another reason, or was another reason, even apart from the 2.5 times madly, deeply in love, another reason why I chose the life alone. And of course it's lonely, it could not not be. But also, it allows one, you know that great line when in the Gospel, I think in all the Gospels, Mary took these things into her heart and pondered them when she has the visitation from the Holy Ghost about being pregnant. Well, writing is a kind of pregnancy, indeed, a book is. Unfortunately, it extends beyond the 9 months.
I want to ask another question about a moment that you describe in Country Girl. And you describe it as a pivotal moment. One of the people who came to your house was Audie Lang, the psychotherapist. And you were his patient for 6 months, and then Audie Lang.
Oh, Audie Lang, oh yes, Audie Lang, the Scottish, the Glasgow genius.
Yes. So you say that after you did LSD with him, and you describe the day.
Yes.
And it was a very harrowing day. And then you say, this was the dividing line in my writing life, that there was a way that you approached your writing after that was different from what you had done before.
Yes.
You can talk about that.
Absolutely. I took, at my own request, LSD with Audie Lang. And I was a bit strict with Audie Lang. Most people were. I think it's called transference, but never mind. So he came to my house on a May morning, 6th of May, 1970. And I had lovely flowers, peony roses. I was preparing for something happy, even though, to his credit, he had given me some papers in which the evidence of previous people, especially Roman Catholics, had very bad LSD trips, crucifixions. I have read these, but blithely I thought it would not happen to me. So he came, and uncustomarily for him, he was wearing a suit and a tie. Normally in his room, patients came, he wore just a jumper or something. So he looked very smart, and he looked formal, and he gave me the LSD in a beaker. I think a lot of LSD. He mentioned that probably I loved Baudelaire. That was the last sensible thing I heard. records that I've read of other unfortunate people who had taken the stuff, it said that if you feel frightened, once you've taken it, if the ground begins to go from under you, the chair from under you, if reality and everything is gone and you're just, that it helps to be with someone and ask them to take your hand, to hold your hand. Now I reached my hand out and telling him this of my boundless terror and the need for the hand. And at that moment, absolutely not, well, it was a hallucination, but it was a palpable hallucination. It took the form of life. He, in the suit with the tie, turned into a rat. That's what it's funny, but it isn't actually that funny when it's happening. And I had a huge trip. I had a terrible trip. I broke waters when I gave birth. I had the fires of hell, which were also the blood of my mother. In short, to put it mildly, as Mr. Beckett was often wont to say, I did not need LSD. I had some already built in my DNA. I used to read a lot of journals. I read in San Francisco, Timothy Leary, all that. People took LSD, got on buses, worked in banks, so on. It had a very drastic, profound effect on me. And it took me the best part of a year to return to what I can only partially call normal life, because I don't believe there's any such thing as normal life. And where it changed my writing, as you have mentioned or pointed out, it made me deeper. It made me delve more, frighteningly in some way, and hopefully in another way, more courageously, delve into my own unconscious. Because writing comes from the unconscious, writing fiction or drama. There's other great writing, there's great reportage. In this country, there's great reportage in some of your papers. But it made me, the fear that I lived, but more than fear, if there is such a thing, the depths to which I plunged informed what came after, not immediately. So the book that came after that is a galloping monologue with some of the influence of Molly Bloom, but not nearly as happy, not nearly as lustful. There's lust in it, but not nearly as Molly Bloom knows who she is. And the book that came was called Night. And Night is a monologue, as I said, but it's also, it's raveled, as my mind was raveled, but it's conscious raveling. If I had written it the night I came down from the LSD, it would be berserk, because I was talking, and my neighbor was Ted Allen, and the other neighbor was Sean Connery, which is not name dropping, it just happens they were neighbors. So around midnight, they came to visit me, because I hadn't wronged them or anything, and they often used to come in for have a drink or see me. They knocked on the door at midnight, and I had a long hallway, and I crawled along the hall, I was able to get up and open the door, and Ted Allen looked and said, whatever he gave you, I want it. And I remember talking to him, because when the worst was over, in the last hour of the trip lasted 16 hours, in the last, or 14 hours, in the last hour of the trip, I began to talk aloud as if, and indeed I wished that someone would be in the room. And I began, I love painting. After language, painting is my greatest love. And I began to talk about Rembrandt and the second wife of Rembrandt, Saskia, and the gold dip of her sleeve. So that I was talking to them in that manner. And it did help. I do not regret it, even as Camus says in the Myth of Sisyphus. I do not regret it, but it certainly took a lot out of me. It did.
Let me now ask you about this book, the new book. I wonder, does everyone know what the little red chairs are? What are they first? I'm going to ask you if you would. I think just to read this short paragraph at the beginning of it. It's a very short paragraph that says what the little red chairs are. On the 6th of April, 2012, to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the start of the siege of Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb forces, 11,541 red chairs were laid out in rows along the 800 meters of the Sarajevo High Street. One empty chair for every Sarajevan killed during the 1,425 days of siege. 643 small chairs represented the children killed by snipers and the heavy artillery fire from the surrounding mountains. I think this is an image very familiar to Europeans, maybe less so in this country. It is a stunning thing to see, this row of red chairs down through the street of Sarajevo.
The visitors, well, they were great, it was the anniversary, 25th anniversary of the siege, and there was a huge, foreign visitors, journalists, local, everything. And the visitors, those who came, were very solemn and moved by the sight in this huge square of all these chairs. They cried when they saw the little chairs. So it was a beautiful way, without language, of reminding them.
You've just described the book that came to you after taking LSD. This book came in a very different way. This book came from an event. It came from this terrible carnage that had happened. I wonder when you knew that you would write a book about it. What was it that spoke to you and said, you will write about it?
Yes. Well, like everyone, including present time, but this was 5 years ago, I am very conscious, very aware, very ashamed sometimes of my own, in a way, privileged life compared with the slaughter that goes on in the world around. In short, I feel about it, I also feel impotent or helpless. So that's a generalization, but it's the truth. I was also, I reached a point, even though I'd written in some novels set in Ireland that had bigger themes than just my urban themes, that had the abortion in Ireland, a girl who is raped by her own father carrying a child, and the entire country using it as a political issue that they either are for or against. Shall she or shall she not be let out to have an abortion? And I also wrote about an IRA man in the north coming to the south and breaking into a house where there's an old woman, oldish woman, and their dialogue, or their dialectic, as Socrates would call it, in which they both, in some way, not sexually, but in some deep way, love each other and yet are divided in their politics. So I wrote those books, and I wrote about a murder in a forest. As you can see, my themes are really Happy Christmas to you. But I wanted to bring myself out into the world more. And I wanted to bring the world in an intimate way, in a personalized way, in a human, hopefully credible story into my book. And I was blessed with two things. One is seeing on European television, where I happened to be, seeing Radovan Karadžić, one of the three architects of the Bosnian War, called the Beast of Bosnia, being taken indeed off a bus on his way to the Black Sea for a holiday, and indeed having a ponytail and a crystal and a black robe. The metamorphosis from the soldier, or the commander rather, who went up hills with bouffant hair and artillery and a convoy of soldiers, the metamorphosis from that image to the man getting off the bus was genius in his way. This metamorphosis is unbelievable. How could this man be so clever? And of course that cleverness served him well. So it stayed in my mind, and I thought, I might be able to make a story of that. But you can't write a story from long distance. You have to root a story. It has to be grounded in a place and with people. I could write an article, but I couldn't write a novel. So the gods helped me. I was with a director in a garden in Dublin, and they were doing a little documentary of my life, Masha's life, I'm mourning for my, anyhow, they were doing documentary. We were waiting for the camera, And this man, Charlie McCarthy, said, Tolstoy maintains that there are only two great themes for story in the world. One is a man on a journey, i.e. Hamlet. The other is a stranger comes to town. Like Gary Cooper. We all like Gary Cooper to come to town. And at that moment, I said, oh, I know how to write my novel. I know what to do. I bring that man to a village that I know the road, I know the footpath, I know the town pump, I know everyone in it, I know what the birds sound like, I know the trees around the wooded road, etc. I know it. It's my landscape. So that was, if you like, the happy bit. Then the doing of it was hard and at moments terrifying when the woman is taken. She's taken by the three men who had come to get this man because they wanted the booty. There was a million of this man's head. So they missed him by minutes. They also hated him because although they had were comrades in the war and they fought side by side, when peace ended, he dropped them. He and his higher up, the higher up people, made the spoilers of war. You know, in black market, in all sorts of business. After war, as Brecht wrote, in Mother Courage, you get business. So he had, in their eyes, they had fought and they had lost brothers and so on. He had deserted them, he had betrayed them. So they'd come to get him for two reasons. The loot, which was huge, 1 million, and to take their revenge on him. They were in the town that day, they were drinking. They were urinating in the river, they were making noise, and they learned from gossip that this local woman, Fidelma, had more than a platonic friendship with this man. So when they cannot get him, they get her, and the revenge is hideous. So she leaves there, and she has to come, and this is the other part of the writing of the book. But, she comes to London, as I said, and she's given shelter by an African woman who puts on her ceremonial dress in this poor place, in a flat in some part of London where I was. She puts on this dress, the African woman, she said, when I wear this dress, I draw the world. And it's about, that part of it set in London, is about the dreams, and if you like, the broken dreams and the aspirations of the people who have nothing. So that took a lot of research of a different kind. And I was very fortunate in going to centers where migrants and refugees, etc., were. And of course, when people have been torn from their own people or their own country, when they've had to leave, when they can never go back, or because they never want to go back, when they've lost children, etc., there is the greatest truth. It's a poetic, it's like poetry. Because it's truly true in what they tell you. So I was welcomed to these centers and these places, and that is a very rigmarole long answer to how I came to write the book. And then at the very end, of course, my character, as although my character does not resemble me, or I hope she doesn't, had to go to The Hague for the final hearing. She had to confront the man on whom she had built this image of greatness. And I went to The Hague, well, I went many times. But I went for the final hearings, and I was put seating next to four women, all gray. They looked gray, their hair was gray, their eyes was gray, their souls were gray. And they kept staring at this man. They just kept staring, and you could feel the hate, pouring out of them through the plate glass. And they were at first suspicious of me, but then they weren't suspicious, because no one was sure who was on his side or who was his enemy. There was nobody had their names on. So I was allowed to speak to these men, women, one day down in the lobby, and they had such sad, incensed eyes, and with grief, grievance, and yet a flicker of hope. And I asked the translator in the lobby to ask one of the women what would give her. She'll never get her sons back, but what would give her something to hold on to? And she said, a bone, just one bone of one of my sons. So as you see, along the way, I was given a lot of help, and I wasn't totally alone.
No, I'm seeing that we're running long. My time management has never been the best thing about me. I do want to open the floor for just a moment for a question or two, and then Edna has agreed to read just a page from the last bit.
Just a page. I overwent the time when I read, and I'm very sorry. Yeah. We should have a watch, Steve.
So there are two microphones. If there are questions that anyone is wanting to ask, now is the time.
Failure.
Anyone, here comes someone.
A question about you said you wrote by hand, and so many people write on computers these days, and I think heard you say how important that was, that it went sort of from the head through the heart through the arm. Could you just talk a little bit about why you write by hand? And then my second question is, when you were reading in the beginning, it sounded very biblical, the rhythm of your language, and I imagine the Bible was important when you grew up. And what is that imprint on you, both the language and just the worldview of that book?
Can you just paraphrase the end?
Yes. Thank you.
First part of the question was about writing by hand.
Yes.
And what that means. And the second part of the question was about the Bible and the influence.
About what?
The Bible and the influence of biblical language.
Thank you for the question. It's probably that I'm so old and so old-fashioned, but I do like to write with the pen. I cannot conceive of writing a book on a machine. I would feel the machine intervened. And as you put it, I think the connection between head, heart, soul, whatever those zones are, the blood, the arm, to me, it matters. It could be a superstition of mine, but it's a superstition I hold on to. So that is the first part. In terms of the language, one of my great heroes is from your country, whom this evening his name features in it, and that's Mr. Faulkner. I love Faulkner. I reread Faulkner very often. I also read Hemingway very often. I read lots of people very often. But Faulkner had, he was drawn towards a biblical language. Scripture, well, Bible more than scripture. So is Beckett. Beckett writes like Job. I love that kind of language, or that just a kind of language. I love the flow and the power and the sacredness of that kind of language. It may not be sacred in tandem with the Ten Commandments, or my Catholic upbringing. It may not be sacred in that way, but each word is given and therefore gives to the reader a whole powerhouse. And by reading and rereading, which to me is the best way of all to read, is to reread, that language helps one. You see, there's many ways of writing. And there are a lot of very good contemporary authors, and I'm not going to start naming the ones I like or the ones I don't like. I have enough trouble in this world. But I do find in contemporary writing an overemphasis on worldliness, on being cool, and a glut of language that doesn't help to go inside the soul of the story. Whereas when I reread Faulkner, or the Bible, or Beckett, or some others, or the poems of Emily Dickinson, I feel I am in the company of someone great, and I feel enriched by it, inspired by it. And in the best sense of the word, one has to be honest, made ambitious by it. I always wanted to be a writer. It was what I wanted from the cradle, I feel. I believed and still believe that words are talismanic. I believe that words have an animus, have a life. And therefore, to do what I am trying to do, and to continue what I'm trying to do, which isn't exactly a wrong, but language, Bible, Faulkner, etc., etc., is meat and drink to me. Don't think I don't like drink, because I do. That language I could not live without it.
You know, I see how far we've gone over. I think maybe that's a good place to leave it. That was wonderfully said. I think we have been in the presence of someone great. I feel enriched and inspired, and I thank you very much.